session number 12385, rule 6.
Yes. One of the biggest outlays for, and one thing they must have in tip-top condition is for going round Cape Horn is the very finest canvas. When you're in the tropics and the light winds and so on, you have worn, patched old sails that are thin and so on, because you don't get strong winds, but the others would cost, even at that time, hundreds and hundreds of pounds there of number O storm canvas, that is, that you'd use, and that he got in there. And then when we were getting near Cape Horn, we had to change the sails from the light sail, or when we were actually approaching the Roaring Forties there, that had to change all the sails. And when it came to the mainsail, we dragged out the mainsail for bending onto the mainmast, the very biggest sail of all. And then right in the centre of this was a big square that had been cut out of the centre of this enormously expensive number O storms, storm canvas. The skipper almost hit the roof, and they had everyone on deck in freezing weather, going through all their... of course, we all knew who was responsible. Then he was saying he wasn't going to give us anything, food or anything like that, until we admitted who did it and that sort of thing. But eventually then they came across this young cadet's boots, and I thought he was going to throw him overboard at first, but... it just passed that he wasn't, for the rest of the 2 years apprenticeship, he wasn't going to get any pay or something like that. So that, anyway, that passed over. But this is just an amusing incident that... and another thing is that also, apart from... You asked what we had to eat. Well, we had salt pork and salt beef. We also had... indescribably awful soup, which apparently the Scandinavians like. It is a soup made with meat and so on, but also with fruit in it, so that wouldn't be. It was like dried peaches, dried apples, dried apricots, and so on there. But so you had a mixture of this sort of sickliness and a sort of beef soup. But anyway, eventually you eat anything. And another thing is that the other soup that you had, the lentils, I think it was lentils, but anyway, that sort of thing that that the cook had been using for this, is just, I don't know where, it was infested with weevils, you started by when it was cooked up, you know, you'd complain to the cook about it, and he said, well, that's how it is, you know, it's all that, you can't, so he says, so you try, first of all, of getting these weevils about a couple of hundred in a bowl of soup or something on the edge of the plate. But in the end, you just gave it up and just ate the weevils and everything. The salt pork and the salt beef, that you get used to that. In fact, it was quite enjoyable in a way. And the vegetables, what they had with it, I can't, as I say, I can't recollect what they... But also when they came out from Finland... they brought a lot of little piglets with them, and they had big crates sheltered under the forecastle head, huge crates for these tiny little piglets when they brought them out. And of course, by a year later, or almost a year later, they'd grown into huge things there. I don't recollect we had any of that in the Roaring Forties, but when we managed to get round Cape Horn, and then they decided it's almost like a ritual, a special day. I don't know whether it was on Captain's birthday or some church holiday or what have you, that one of the huge porkers would be slaughtered, and we'd have for the rest of the week really fresh food, and so that this was a very, very gentle breeze flowing. We got the thing out, and the captain had his Luger pistol there that the easiest way is to shoot it and then cut its throat. It's like some fantastic silent movie or something. Everyone, the pig wasn't having any of this. And he was thrashing about, and the danger was, although he's such a huge animal, they thought he was going to jump over the side, perhaps be eaten by sharks or something. So everyone was trying to catch this thing, scurrying around the deck. And there was a big, lanky German boy again there. The captain in Swedish swearing and every other thing, hold it, you know, and a mixture of English and Swedish and German swear words pouring out. And then he's waving about with this pistol, and then he shoots the pig, and either before or afterwards it goes through the fleshy part of the arm of this lanky German. And he's letting out a screech, and the pig still wasn't, he was still racing around and something, so that everyone forgot this poor lanky German boy and was just concentrating on the, even if he's dying, I don't think we would have bothered much about that. We just wanted to catch another bullet put the end to that. And we had wonderful fresh meals there for a while. We had about four or five of those pigs killed, but not with the same consequences, of course. As I said, we reached, I think it was 186 days or something.
Can I ask you a couple of things before we talk about London?
Pardon?
Can I ask you a couple of things
about
the ship? First of all, did you have a rum ration or a grog ration?
Yes, I think we had cognac, I think, yes.
Every day?
Pardon?
Every day or not? It wasn't like in
the Navy, got a feeling that in just the very cold weather we had it. No, we didn't have it every day.
And what did you do when you weren't on watch?
When you were what?
When you weren't on watch,
When you went, first of all, that we had this watch. Another thing is, I remember I could do at that time with very little sleep. And I remember one of the Finnish boys, instead of going in my bunk when the watch was over, I was reading. I was always a great reader, and I was reading this, and this fellow woke up and came over to me, sort of amazed, and said, oh, you wake, don't you ever sleep, or something like that. What would we do when
in your breaks?
In the bad weather, when this was when the forecastle wasn't flooded out, we would just be reading or something like that, and or mending your socks or mending your jeans and so on. Always something to do, but other thing, of course, when you come into the beautiful tropics and so on, where we become for a lot of the time, on your watch off, you rig hammocks up on the forecastle head, and you just laid back in hammocks and took in the sun. Or, above all, you did a great deal of fishing with harpoons, and I forgot to mention that in the tropical waters we caught quite a few bonito and other tropical fish that helped us out considerably with fresh fish we fished for sharks sometimes that once or twice we caught sharks, and we cut steaks off those and so on. The other time is that in the better weather you were chipping and painting all the time. All the time you were chipping off the off the old paint and repainting with red lead. I think probably that's prohibited right now, but we didn't think there was any danger in using that, just ad lib red lead, and the some slung over the side and doing the outside. Of course, they've got a very low freeboard, these ships, when they're loaded, these windjammers, but any part that showed any rust, if it wasn't the waves weren't too big, they'd be chipping and painting outside as well. And then renewing all the rigging, I've forgotten that part all the time. And in the bad weather, too, you were making, I've forgotten what they call them now, you have to get tufts of odd lengths of cord and cut them in short tufts and so on, and put them on a line, and that is put on the ship to prevent the chafing of the sails against the rigging. That takes in the very bad weather. That was often an easy job. You were in the shelter of the forecastle and you were doing that. That's better than the holy stoning of the decks.
Or was there any sort of music on the boat? Anyone play any instruments or anything like that?
Yes, some of the fellows had a banjo. One had a guitar, I think, and a couple of violin things. So that and we sang all these sea chanties, which of course were really alien to Scandinavian sailors. They're American and English sea shanties, but they all knew the words. And
so did you communicate mainly in English?
Yes. All the orders were given in Swedish. Although it was a Finnish boat, as it came from the Åland Islands, all the people in the Åland Islands, they used to belong to Sweden, they all speak Swedish, and very, very few, we had a few genuine Finns on board that came from the mainland. They were mostly peasants and so on that had come there. They would have difficulty with the Swedish if they hadn't spoken it, but they would know some Swedish. the officers and so on probably wouldn't know more than the smattering of Finnish words. It's probably quite different now, but I've forgotten everything, of course, where the different yards and masts and so on were all in Swedish. The watches were in Swedish, and the orders were given in Swedish. And I did pick up a few words of Swedish, but most of all, they all spoke English too, because they'd been so frequently to Britain. So that so I found it easier to speak to them in English.
Bill, did you ever discuss politics on the ship?
No, that's one thing I was very, very careful of, because I, at that time, unlike the Finland of today, which is a sort of progressive country, not communist by any means, but communists went, even though they've had a war with the communists in the meantime, communism is quite more accepted now, but at that time, I think all they remembered was not that Lenin gave them their freedom there. They just remembered the Tsarist oppression, and they didn't want anything connected with Russia or anything. So I thought it's just safest when you're on a ship like that. There's so many accidents can happen. You can just find yourself floating in the ocean and the ship going ahead there. But there was just one case. Of course, I was always very, very careful when climbing. These young fellows on the ship, and often they were as young as 15 years of age and so on, and it's terribly undermanned. I think the total number of for working this ship, I think when the British ran the Archibald Russell in the early 1900s, they would have probably at least 70 of a crew on board. We had 26, so that but I was very careful, and I always remembered an old sailor saying to me, always have one hand for the ship and one for yourself, and if there's any danger, two hands for yourself and to hell with the ship. And I always remembered that, and I think that showed with these young guys, so that I was on, we were bending, I don't know what we were doing quite, I think it was the lower main topsail yard, and right on the very end, luckily, this same fellow who got a bullet through his arm later on, we were working on the end of the yard. I don't know whether we were bending on. I think we were probably preparing to bend on a new sail after the thing. And we were just making about 4 knots an hour or something, that just barely making headway. And then he starts fooling around, wrestling on the end of the yard, and then sort of punching and wrestling, sort of just sort of fooling around. And then I felt myself slipping and grabbed hold of him. We both went into the sea. Of course, he wouldn't do that in a gale or anything like that. And even that was an experience. It was over 100-foot drop, I would say, that 90 to 100 feet, I would say, anyway. But the biggest again, the greatest, although we were only making slow headway, that the ship had got to be brought about. And bringing a ship about before, when, as I mentioned, you had these big crews, the Archibald Russell, all the German crews for the P ships there, that they'd just they'd call all the watch together and bring back the yards. You've got to bring the yards right back with the braces on the P ships you have brace winches anyway, which but with the Archibald Russell, all the braces had to be laid along the deck. One lot, the lee side tightened, and then when you're ready, the whole. But both watches had to be called too. Whatever they were doing, everyone was brought into play, even the donkey man and the carpenter and so on. And then they'd swing the braces and bring the ship around, so that it's quite a job to do that. Quite a lot of time is wasted, and it's got to be a big arc, and then they've got to come there, and then it's got to be hove to while a ship is lowered, a boat is lowered, and so on. The two, but all the time, I wasn't worrying about all the trouble on the ship. I was worrying about if there were any sharks around, so that. But we were down there, and we got a big dressing down from the officers. Of course, they didn't know that. The other fellow was fooling around. I didn't say it was his fault or anything. They just said that I slipped, and then grabbed hold of him, and we both went into the drink. But anyway, that was that.
Did you ever talk about politics with the German guys? Were they?
Pardon?
Did the German sailors ever talk about Germany or Hitler or anything like that? Because he'd been in power by that stage, hadn't he?
Oh no, he wasn't in power by this. This
what year was
he was just coming to power, 1932.
Right, so it's just before then, right? Okay.
Yes, but we didn't. You know, that would have been in my mind before I was on the ship. Of course, I discussed that with my great friend Erich von Murray, who was the fireman on this other ship going to Germany. But somehow the Finns went there. They were neutral, and they expected to remain neutral. And these German fellows, I found, whatever their political views, I never discussed it with them. I presume they would mostly be from the wealthy classes, either going into the merchant marine or into the navy, and they would be the part sort of people that didn't support Hitler, but they wouldn't oppose him if it was for the good of the fatherland or something. That so that. It just didn't occur. I never recollect ever getting into an argument on politics all the nearly 6 months or so that I was on the ship. When I got to England here, that there was the there was a smaller, much smaller bark. I think it was called the Loch Linnhe. That was carrying timber from the Baltic to London, and they're always having accidents on these ships, and a couple of the fellows were injured in a fall of the timber on the ships, and they wanted someone. If it had just been one, they would have made it okay, but as they were short-handed anyway. And I signed on the ship to Finland, on the Loch Linney, and the...
So how long were you in London for before you did that?
Pardon?
How long were you in London for before you did that?
Oh, not very long, only about between a week and 2 weeks, I suppose. That
You went ashore? Yeah.
Oh, yes, went ashore then, that, and I met my half-brother here and so on. Then I thought, well, it's a chance to see Europe, although I didn't see much of it. But I signed on this, and I can't remember. And I made it to the Åland Islands. I never spoke to... Ericsson, but I saw him there walking along the quayside once or twice. He seemed an old man. I can't recollect what he looked like now. And then when I was there, there was another ship loaded with timber, and just on the tip of my tongue, the name of the other ship. I can't recollect it, and...
The Longy, you said, or something.
Pardon?
The Longy? No. The Longy or something. The Longy or something you said just then. What was the ship you just mentioned?
Loch Linney.
Loch Linney.
Yes, that, of course, was an original... that, of course, was an original Scotch... Scots vessel. That's the one that I signed on to there. But as it was going to go all the way up the coast in Finland, getting timber and so on from the different small ports, that I don't know, for some reason it wasn't practical or something, that anyway, they said I should sign on another ship that was already loaded in the Åland Islands. I've forgotten the name of the capital of the Åland Islands now. I've got a terrible memory now. But anyway, that I signed on this ship and returned to London on that. And then I met up with my brethren for a while. And then I took a ship back then to Canada. So, I think I went north to Manchester. I've got a feeling, yes, it was Manchester, and I got a job on a ship going to Canada. At, yes, I think one of the Manchester liners, and then I got to Canada at. And I think for some reason I signed on another ship then, another English ship. I think it was the Vardulia, but in which order, I don't know. It may be in the Vardulia was the first one, a Scottish ship that by this time it was dead winter. And when I signed on the Vardulia, that... it was, I signed on in Quebec City, and it was going to Montreal, but by this time the it had frozen over, the St. Lawrence wasn't, it was closed to navigation, and in fact, again, it was the last ship to leave, the Vardulia to leave Quebec. Was completely iced over at not just opposite Quebec and Levis, but there it was fairly clear. But as soon as you got down a little downstream a little bit, we were plowing through ice, and we had icebreakers ahead of us because they didn't want to be stuck in Canada all. Winter, and anyway, then the icebreakers left us. We had some fairly clear sea until we got to the mouth of the St. Lawrence there. Then it was, every way you looked, it was gone completely completely frozen over, and we were really that was almost a recurrence of the nightmare that we had on the Archibald Russell, that there was no proper heating in the forecastle on the Vardulia, that ice would form on the inside where it was just about the water line there, and it was freezing cold all the time, and we're stuck in the St. Lawrence I suppose for about 1 week, around a week, a little more. I think it was a week or 10 days, and so on. I've again one or two pictures there. Then the Canadian icebreakers came and freed a passage for us. And then we made it, and we had a terrific gale on the way over that... anyway, we made it to, I think it was Glasgow or something that, I then got another ship back to Canada, and it's interesting to note that the following year, the Vardulia, the ship was caught in the ice, went down with a loss of all hands, so it looks as though she strained her the